Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy, Pete Musto, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
Unlike many other countries, the United States does not have one single governing body that sets education policy for the entire nation. The Department of Education creates some rules, but the way in which schools operate is mostly decided by the individual states. Some say this gives schools more freedoms to serve the different needs of different populations. Yet, many experts argue there is a need for a more united effort for exploring ways to improve the education system. This argument is especially common within the American higher education community. For example, the Institute for College Access and Success last month released a report calling for the federal government to improve data reporting. The organization asked the government to create a single measurement of job placements for college graduates. But one organization has decided not to wait for the government to take action. Instead, it is aiming to create one of the largest joint efforts to gather information about the higher education experience in the nation's history.
Ricardo Torres is the president of the National Student Clearinghouse, an independent, nonprofit education organization. He says higher education community members created the organization nearly 15 years ago because of a lack of data reporting on the part of the federal government. The Department of Education does have a system for reporting information about colleges and universities. It is called the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, or IPEDS. But Torres argues that this system is lacking in several ways. For example, up until 2017, it only published data on first-time, full-time college students. Torres notes that, before 2017, the system did not look at part-time students, and it did not publish the rate of college completion by low-income students receiving federal aid. Also, it still does not look at students who change schools. Torres told VOA, "The fact that you have all these ways to complete a journey creates a giant complexity, and that's called keeping track of who is actually completing and how institutions are able to help a learner along the way." This kind of information is very important, Torres says. It can affect how soon college students must begin paying back their student loans. And it greatly affects an institution's understanding of how well it is serving its students.
The National Student Clearinghouse has worked with over 3,600 institutions to gather and share this kind of data. In 2017, it sought to expand these efforts by testing a new program, the Post-Secondary Data Partnership, or PDP. As part of the testing, three state systems and several individual schools shared as much data as they could related to student access to higher education, their academic progress, and finally, their successful completion of college. In 2018, the PDP expanded to include a larger number of the National Student Clearinghouse's partner institutions. Torres says the aim is to gather more data from even more institutions this year. This includes information on the kinds of classes students take, their performance in those classes, and even their parents' education background. Once this information is gathered, PDP researchers process the data and present it to the institutions and other organizations. They aim to present the results in a clear, easy-to-understand way. They also make sure the information schools are reporting is correct, which is important considering they identified 6.5 million errors in the data they gathered last year, Torres says. Bruce Vandell says these are exactly the kinds of tools his organization needs to be successful. Vandell is the senior vice president of Complete College America, a partnership of 46 higher education systems and institutions. His group works to make sure that low-income, minority, and first-generation students have the chance to attend and succeed in college. Vandell calls the PDP the most centrally organized data collection effort yet. In the past, schools and education organizations were doing their own disconnected research, often repeating the work others had already done. On some level, the field has matured and actually has clarity about the work that could be done, said Vandell. And so, in that respect, it sort of represents progress in the field, whereas before, you can imagine, everybody sort of had their own take and were looking at different sets of data.
The education department may now be gathering more data, but they still have not decided what their goals for that data are or how to use it, Vandell adds. Having one central body gathering and processing all this data reduces work for the institutions and the organizations they work with. Instead, the institutions and organizations can spend more time examining efforts to support students, he says. For example, in the past, many institutions placed students who performed poorly in high school into special lower-level math and English classes. This was seen as a chance for these students to prove they were, in fact, ready to perform at the college level in those subjects. But Complete College America found that a large number of students put in these classes never complete their education. These classes add to the traditional amount of time it takes to complete a study program, so they increased education costs. Now, Vandell notes, some institutions have begun to place lower-performing students in normal classes, but with additional support services. Ricardo Torres says the value of this data is so clear that other countries have asked his group for advice on how to gather information of their own. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Okay, who here has never made a mistake? The answer is, of course, no one. Mistakes are not just a fact of life. They are an important part of the learning process. However, regretting our mistakes day in and day out is not healthy. We need to learn from them and then move on. But do not take my word for it. One of America's most famous and influential writers and thinkers, Ralph Waldo Emerson, said it much better than I can. Before we hear his famous statement, let's talk about some words he used in it. When Emerson says blunders and absurdities, he simply means mistakes. To do something filled with peaceful feelings is to do something serenely. However, to be encumbered is the opposite. This means to be heavy and loaded down with things. To Emerson, those things are past mistakes, or as he calls them, your old nonsense. Now here's Brian Lynn reading Ralph Waldo Emerson's famous quote.
Finish each day and be done with it. You have done what you could. Some blunders and absurdities no doubt crept in. Forget them as soon as you can. Tomorrow is a new day. You shall begin it serenely and with too high a spirit to be encumbered with your old nonsense.
To this day, many people use this quote to remind themselves not to dwell in the past. When we dwell on something, we think about it constantly. It becomes a distraction and keeps us from moving forward. Now, this famous quote is useful, but it is a bit long. Perhaps you would rather use a shorter, food-related idiom to help you move on and forget your past mistakes. In that case, you can say, "Don't cry over spilt milk." When we cry over spilt milk, we are upset or sad about something bad we have done that cannot be undone. This is another way of saying, what's done is done. You cannot change the past. So stop thinking about it. If you spill milk, you cannot gather it back up and put it back in the container. We usually use the expression this way. There's no use crying over spilled milk. Spilled or spilt are both okay. Some say this expression was first used in the mid-1600s in England. Back then, the expression was, no weeping for shed milk. If old quotes and food expressions are still not working for you, there are other ways to state this idea. Let's say past regrets continue to trouble your boss. You can use a word we heard earlier, dwell. You might tell your boss, don't dwell on the past. You cannot change it. So why worry about it? You must move on and look toward the future. This is all very polite. And the word dwell works well here, as it is somewhat formal. It's good for a pep talk with your boss. But what if one of your close friends is having the same kind of problem? What if this friend has been stuck in the past for far too long? They need a very different type of pep talk. It may be time for you to tell your friend,
Get over it. Now, this could sound rude. After all, it is a wake-up call, a warning to change for the better. And those can be hard for people to hear and accept. But if someone has been crying over spilt milk for months or even years, a wake-up call is necessary. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
You cry over spilt milk. You keep your tears in a jar. You think the world is gonna end tomorrow. Ain't it beautiful how different we are?
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the summer of 1858, two candidates campaigned across the state of Illinois for a seat in the United States Senate. That seat belonged to Stephen Douglas from the Democratic Party. He was seeking re-election. His opponent was a lawyer from the newly established Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. This week in our series, Frank Oliver and Larry West tell us about this campaign of statewide, but also national importance.
Abraham Lincoln proposed that he and Stephen Douglas hold several debates. The rules for each debate would be the same. One man would speak for an hour. His opponent would speak for an hour and a half. Then the first man would speak for half an hour to close the debate. Douglas agreed. There were seven debates in all. They were held in towns throughout Illinois. In some places, there was great interest in what the two candidates had to say. Thousands of people attended. Douglas was a short, heavy man. One reporter said he looked like a fierce bulldog. Douglas' friends and supporters called him the Little Giant. Lincoln was just the opposite. He was very tall and thin, with long arms and legs. His clothes did not fit well, and he had a plain face, one which many thought was ugly. He looked more like a simple farmer than a candidate for the United States Senate.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates covered party politics and the future of the nation. But everything the two men discussed was tied to one issue, slavery. Douglas spoke first at the first debate. He questioned a statement made in one of Lincoln's campaign speeches. Lincoln had said that the United States could not continue to permit slavery in some areas while banning it in others. He said the Union could not stand so divided. It must either permit slavery everywhere or nowhere. Douglas did not agree. He noted that the country had been half slave and half free for 70 years. Why then, he asked, should it not continue to exist that way? The United States was a big country. What was best for one part might not be best for another.
Then Douglas questioned Lincoln's statement on the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision. Lincoln had said he opposed the decision because it did not permit Negroes to enjoy the rights of citizenship. Douglas said he believed the decision was correct. He said it was clear that the government had been made by white men for white men. He said he opposed Negro citizenship. "I do not accept the Negro as my equal," Douglas said, "and I deny that he is my brother. However," he said, "this does not mean I believe that Negroes should be slaves. Negroes should enjoy every possible right that does not threaten the safety of the society in which they live. Every state and territory must decide for itself what these rights will be. Illinois decided that Negroes will not be citizens, but that it will protect their life, property, and civil rights. It keeps from Negroes only political rights and refuses to make Negroes equal to white men. That policy satisfies me," Douglas said, "and it satisfies the Democratic Party."
Then Lincoln spoke. First, he denied that the Republican Party was an abolitionist party. "I have no purpose," he said, "either directly or indirectly, to interfere with slavery where it exists. I believe I have no legal right to do so, nor do I wish to do so. I do not," Lincoln said, "wish to propose political and social equality between the white and black races. But," he went on, "there is no reason in the world why Negroes should not have all the natural rights listed in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." "I agree with Judge Douglas," Lincoln said, "that the Negro is not my equal in many ways, certainly not in color, perhaps not mentally or morally. But in the right to eat the bread that his own hand earns, he is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every living man."
Lincoln then defended his statement that the United States could not continue half slave and half free. He said he did not mean that customs or institutions must be the same in every state. He said it was healthy and necessary for differences to exist in a country so large. He said different customs and institutions helped unite the country, not divide it. But Lincoln questioned if slavery was such an institution. He said slavery had not tied the states of the Union together, but had always been an issue that divided them. How had the country existed half slave and half free for so many years? Lincoln asked. Because, he said, the men who created the government believed that slavery was only temporary. Once people understood that slavery was not permanent, the crisis would pass. Slavery could be left alone in the South until it slowly died. That way, Lincoln said, would be best for both the white and black races.
Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln were campaigning for a Senate seat from the state of Illinois. But their debates had national importance, too. Douglas expected to be the Democratic candidate for president in 1860. His statements could win or lose him support for that contest. Whenever possible, he tried to show that he was a man of the people, like Lincoln. He tried to show that his Democratic Party was a national party, while the Republican Party was a party only of the North. And he tried to show that Lincoln's policies would lead to civil war.
Lincoln, for his part, may have looked like a simple farmer, but he was a very smart lawyer and politician. He asked questions which he knew would cause trouble for Douglas. He wanted to create a split between Douglas and his supporters in the South. Lincoln also wanted to keep alive the debate over slavery. That, he said, is the real issue. That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself are silent. It is the eternal struggle between right and wrong.
In Illinois in 1858, the state legislature chose the men who would represent the state in the National Senate. So Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln had to depend on legislative support to get to Washington. On Election Day, the legislative candidates supporting Lincoln won 4,000 more popular votes than the candidates supporting Douglas. But because of the way election areas had been organized, the Douglas Democrats won a majority of seats. The newly elected legislature chose him to be senator.
Lincoln was sad that he had not won, but he said he was glad to have tried. The campaign, he said, gave me a hearing on the great question of the age, which I could have had in no other way. And though I now sink out of view and shall be forgotten, I believe I have made some marks which will tell for the cause of civil liberty long after I have gone. Many people, however, did not think Abraham Lincoln would be forgotten. His campaign speeches had been published everywhere in the East. His name was becoming widely known. People began to speak of him as a presidential candidate. To win the presidential election of 1860, the Republican Party had decided it needed a man of the people. He must be a good politician and leader. He must be opposed to slavery, but not too extreme. Many people thought Lincoln could be that man.
After the election in Illinois, Lincoln made several speaking trips in the western states. In none of his speeches did he say he might be a candidate for president in 1860. If anyone said anything about Lincoln for president, he would answer that he did not have the ability. Or he would say there were better men in the party than himself. Lincoln said, "Only events can make a president." He would wait for those events.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.